Originally, Dr. Rosemary Crumlin, OAM, a Sister of Mercy, was scheduled to speak to the Australian Catholic Historical Society in July 2022, but Sister Rosemary is indisposed. Instead, Dr. Darren Mitchell, formerly Director of the New South Wales Anzac Memorial Sydney, speaks about Anzac Day Sydney 1916, an origin story, how the Anglican Church laid the foundations for Australia's National Day of Commemoration. Alongside the link to this podcast on the ACHS website is a link to a PowerPoint file of 18 slides with which Dr. Mitchell has illustrated his talk. We join the talk as he is being introduced by ACHS President Dr. John Carmody.
Fortunately, Darren Mitchell, whom I knew during his years as a PhD student, he and I had had some talks about the possibility of him giving a presentation to the society, and he very generously agreed. And he's going to talk about aspects of his PhD thesis. Darren not only got his PhD from the University of Sydney at the end of last year, but before that, when he was an employee of the state government of New South Wales, one of his responsibilities was the custodianship of the War Memorial in Hyde Park. So he comes from a knowledge of the background and the experience of the significance, in an emotional sense, if you like, the significance of all of those war memorials, which Ken Inglis has documented so well in his book of some years ago, but also from a scholarly perspective of studying it for a PhD. So it's a great pleasure to welcome him today and thank him very much indeed for his generosity in stepping in at almost literally at the last minute to replace Rosemary Crumlin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much, Jack, for your introduction today and for your welcome to me to be a part of your society's meeting this afternoon. As Jack mentioned, we'd had conversations. In fact, he'd been a great encouragement to me during my studies, coming to it in later life, in semi-retirement, in a sense, to undertake postgraduate work. It was terrific to meet people like Jack on campus who are enthusiastic about any research, any new work that might bring to light our past. And I guess as an historian today coming in, I note that you've got a series of busts, which is terrific to remember our past together, but in particular Bennelong, who as an early translator between the arriving settlers and the Indigenous populations, in a sense performed a work of history. As historians, we're involved in the work of translation. We translate what was going on in the past so that we can understand it today. And I hope that by sharing with you a little today of what was going on as Anzac Day emerged, that I might faithfully do that. And I look forward to a question and answer opportunity if that's the case. Is that the case, Jack? We'll have time for that. So again, thank you, Jack. Thank you to you all for welcoming me. I'm the sort of, it's like the little shadow that's sitting across in the park, I notice, which is where an Anglican church once was. You're still here. I'm the sort of ghostly presence, perhaps, of what was once there. So forgive me for speaking so much about Anglicans today. There'll be a couple of references to the Catholic Church as well. But as you would expect and recognise in that time and era, the 1910s and the 1920s, it was the Anglican Church that was leading any religious effort across Sydney and perhaps in other places in Australia. So let me begin. Really, I'm sharing with you today on the theme of resurrection. And I note that it's quite apt that in the Opera House later this week, when the concert hall is reopened, that the performance will be of Gustav Mahler's Resurrection Symphony. And I wonder how many of those who are attending will actually understand what was motivating Mahler, let alone what his sources were bringing to him, both from scripture and from his culture, about what resurrection meant. And in fact, that's what we'll see as we explore in a little detail what was going on that very first Anzac Day commemoration in 1916 in Sydney. Resurrection was to the fore. New rituals were required for Anzac Day, and you can understand why, in a sense, because of the gravity of what was going on in the First World War. when we come to this point in time, in April 1916, the Gallipoli campaign is over and the lack of success is all too evident for those here in Australia and the loss of life and suffering that was a product of it. So the scale of grief, let alone the absent bodies and returning veterans who were beginning to appear with their suffering and their own needs, which would extend for lengthy years beyond the war, all of this meant that there was something to be done about how we might mark Anzac Day. And it's not a surprise once you begin to look even just at newspaper records, let alone institutional records, that the government and other leaders of the day turned to the church to find that solace, to find some way of marking the sacrifice that was occurring and to place it in some sort of context for the people who would attend and across the wider community. And what in fact was established in Sydney in 1916 is what in fact has persisted as our Anzac Day. And to understand this persistence, we benefit from understanding what those new rituals and the new day meant for the people of the time. As I say, the work of the historian is to translate what was the thinking, what was occurring at that time, so we might better understand how they told stories about themselves and their world. And so today I'll give you a talk in two parts. The first, we'll look at what was actually happening on that first Anzac Day commemoration in Sydney in 1916. And then I'm going to look at an early post-war suburban war memorial in Marrickville, which some of you may know of if you're inner city Sydneysiders. It's called Marrickville's Winged Victory. And I will show how it provided a symbolic platform for the rituals that were emerging on Anzac Day itself, and how recent changes to that memorial have in fact screened out the Christian thinking that did inform Anzac Day ritual of the time. So let me begin with Anzac Day 1916. I'll briefly outline the anniversary commemoration and what it looked like. And what we need to remember that in the depths of the war in 1916, as I say, the Gallipoli campaign was over, but the Australians were not yet at the Western Front. So we're in this sort of liminal period. They're not at the Western Front in any substantial number until June and July in 1916. But the Gallipoli campaign has ended in December. And so there's this liminal state for the soldiers, but also the families wondering what are the next steps for the Australians so very far away. But in the midst and in the middle of what we now know to be the middle of the war, I begin not with a departure, but a return. The very Reverend Albert Edward Talbot, Anglican Dean of Sydney, sailed into Sydney Harbour on the 4th of March 1916, and he was greeted by a welcoming party from St Andrew's Anglican Cathedral. Talbot was returning from the Great War, having enlisted almost immediately upon the outbreak of hostilities in August 1914. The timing of his return enabled him to play a leading role in the first Anzac Day commemoration of the Gallipoli landings a few weeks later on the 25th of April 1916. Talbot was himself a veteran of Gallipoli, where he had served as Australia's senior chaplain. Talbot's on the right. He had taken up the position of Dean of the Cathedral in 1912. He'd been called from Manchester by his friend, the Archbishop John Wright, who's on the left of this image. And like many clergy, Talbot also heard the call of the European War in 1914 and signed up for service within a month of Australia declaring war on Germany. Between enlistment in September 1914 and discharge in March 1916, which led to his return to Sydney, Talbot had served many months at Gallipoli. He was frequently at the front line of battle, tending to the anxieties and fears of those who were about to leap from trenches, providing succour to the wounded and burying the dead. Talbot was wounded, in fact, at Lone Pine, where hundreds of Australians lost their life in August 1915. And together with Catholic chaplain Father Edmund McAuliffe, not knowing the denominational allegiances of many of the men, they in fact decided to recite their separate prayers in turn over all of the graves. Among veterans, Talbot's wartime experience in Gallipoli had the ring of authenticity. And among Sydneysiders, as the Dean of Sydney's Anglican Cathedral, his authority was already assured. And so consequently, it is not surprising that within weeks of his return to Sydney, Talbot was to lay lasting foundations for the marking of Anzac Day, foundations that entwined the Gallipoli tragedy with theological truth to both honour the fallen, comfort the bereaved, and instil hope for the future. Because from its earliest incarnations, Anzac Day spoke not only of sacrificial death, but also of resurrection hope. From the beginning of Australia's commemorative traditions that evolved in responses to the sacrifices of the First World War, the evocation of immortality through resurrection held a central place in the liturgy of remembrance. A nation was in mourning on Anzac Day in 1916, a campaign marked in Gallipoli that had ended in withdrawal only a few months before. Many were grieving the serious losses of sons and fathers, uncles and nephews. But amidst this deep mourning, as Australians gathered to pay tribute and remember, hope was also expressed, a collective hope for a return to peace and for post-war reconstruction of a fledgling nation. The act of mourning reflected Good Friday, the day of Jesus' crucifixion, and the expression of hope reflected Easter Sunday, the day of Jesus rising from the dead. And as Good Friday finds its fulfilment in Easter Sunday, so too the grief born of the loss of loved ones in war was assuaged by the hope of a resurrection from the dead, which would reunite those now separated. And so these twin responses of mourning and hope were accommodated uniquely in the formation of the day itself. In Sydney in 1916, the program was divided into two halves. The mourning was devoted to formal ceremony, church services, marches of veterans, and large public outdoor gatherings. And then the afternoon and evening was for sober entertainment. There were modest celebrations of service and national values in picnics, in dinners, and in entertainments. This bifurcated approach resisted a competing call for the whole day to be one of solemnity, which some state capitals were advocating and indeed practiced, particularly in Brisbane, where solemn services continued throughout the day and into the evening. To treat the whole day as a solemn affair would have left mourners on Good Friday mourning the loss of loved ones, but without the hope of Easter Sunday, is the position of Sydney. Throughout 1915, a number of ceremonies and activities had drawn on the actions of Australians and New Zealanders at the Dardanelles and propelled this new acronym, ANZAC, into common nomenclature. As the first reports of casualties had been absorbed, Empire Day on the 24th of May in 1915 became Belgian Day, a targeted day of raising funds in aid of the invaded country that had brought Australia, along with other Empire nations, into the war. The traditional Empire Day services in Melbourne and Sydney's Anglican cathedrals, held on Sunday the 26th of May in 1915, focused on remembering Major General Bridges, who had been killed at Gallipoli. John Moses, another author who has focused a great deal on religion and Anzac Day, suggests that Brisbane Cathedral's Requiem Eucharist for the Fallen, held on the 10th of June 1915, with the state governor in attendance, warrants recognition as the first Anzac service given its broader remembrance focus. In Adelaide, Australia's first civic memorial to the Anzacs, the Dardanelles Memorial, was unveiled on the 7th of September 1915. The City of Church's 8-hour day parade on the 13th of October was turned over to a celebration of the Anzacs and termed Anzac Day, perhaps the first such designation. It was marked by a familiar parade of floats and also served as a fundraising day, as did most occasions of recognition in 1915, with the troops still at Gallipoli. The conception of Anzac Day being marked on 25th of April 1916 across Australia is attributed by John Moses, who I've mentioned, to Anglican Canon David Garland, the Secretary of Brisbane's Anzac Day Commemoration Committee. Some of you may have read Moses' work on this question. Perhaps motivated by a desire to bring a nation together, or possibly to diminish interstate rivalry that pervaded various fundraising days, Garland had written to all states inviting agreement on marking the Gallipoli sacrifices on the same anniversary day. There was also an intent on the part of Garland to introduce and embed a greater degree of respect, as he saw it, into the whole day. He believed that parades, feasts and even fundraising that had been a feature of the various special days throughout 1915 would distract from the truer purpose of the day, to commemorate in solemn fashion the deeds on the battlefront and the suffering at home. Indeed, Garland, an Anglo-Catholic, expressed a desire to establish an Australian All Souls Day. Anzac Day's character was to be expressed by forbidding funds being raised and for there to be no rejoicing. But I would argue and have argued in my thesis that Brisbane's story is not Sydney's story, nor the story of Anzac Day that we still mark today. In Sydney, by then Australia's largest city, a committee had also been appointed, chaired by Hugh McIntosh, entertainment impresario, who was later that year to serve briefly as the president of the Returned Soldiers Association. McIntosh, of Tivoli fame, if you're thinking of your history of Sydney, had hoped it would be a national day too, and he was casting slings at Melbourne authorities, who were slow in their preparations for the day. In fact, Melbourne didn't have an Anzac Day in 1916. The Sydney Morning Herald reports on Anzac Eve that the day's proceedings are to start at 9 o'clock, when every train and tram in the state will be brought to a standstill in order that the passengers may give three cheers for the King, for the Empire and for the Anzacs. Anglican and some Protestant churches were to hold mid-morning services. A parade of returned soldiers, many in cars because of their wounds, would be led by bands through the city streets towards the Domain, when at midday, the most impressive moment of the day will occur, when every man, woman and child is asked to stand still for 1 minute, no matter where they are. Work of all classes was to be suspended for 1 minute at 12 noon to synchronise with the commencement of a public service at the Domain, which was in fact organised by Talbot, when everyone there present would be asked to stand in silence. Talbot began proceedings with a request: heads bare for a moment for the fallen. And this is an image, in fact, with Archbishop Wright at the podium giving his address that day on Anzac at the 12 noon public gathering. Later, the Lord Mayor hosted a luncheon for soldiers and a matinee of entertainment in the afternoon was organised by J.C. Williamson. Further performances in the evening were to be staged for the enjoyment of veterans and families. So from this outline, it is clear that Sydney's observing of Anzac Day was to be very different from that in Brisbane. And in particular, what is obvious and most deliberate is that the Sydney morning was devoted to solemnity and the afternoon evening to something more joyous. The RSA, the Returned Soldiers Association, acknowledged that it would be unbecoming to celebrate such a day by street pageants and hilarity, but at the same time, it would be equally unfitting to make the day one of mourning, of sackcloth and ashes. That's a quote. The eventual 1916 program in Sydney was to balance these sentiments, and the solution, devotion to solemnity in the morning that transitioned into a modest form of celebration in the afternoon and evening. Illustrative of the different conception of morning and afternoon are the two instances of silence, the most solemn of rituals, both of which occurred in the commemorative first half of Anzac Day in Sydney at 9 a.m. and at 12 noon. Across the program for the afternoon and the evening, there is no mention in any news report of a period of silence being observed, either at the Lord Mayor's luncheon or at the evening concert at the Town Hall. This pattern contrasts starkly with that which was gazetted in Queensland by the Anzac Day Commemoration Committee, Garland's committee, which made a public call for a 1 minute silence to be observed during evening meetings, which it hoped would be held in every town across the state precisely at 9 p.m. Silence had also been a significant part not only of the morning religious services in that state, with the Brisbane Courier reporting that soldiers and civilians attending together mourned the dead and paid a tribute of silent respect, but also during the afternoon military marches, where an unspecified period of solemn silence included a firing of three volleys and the bugle sounding of the last post. The utilisation of silence across the full program, morning, afternoon and evening, conformed with the Queensland Committee's expressed desire to see the whole day devoted to solemn commemoration. Talbot, though, had given his imprimatur to the diverse program for the day in Sydney, intimating that having united in a solemn service of prayer, he could see no possible objection to any form of rational entertainment in the afternoon and evening. In fact, he went further than lending his significant advice. He is reported to have said, I quote, "I personally intend to be present at as many entertainments as I can." Sydney's two halves formation in 1916 was not only distinctive, it was also influential, eventually becoming the mode for Anzac Day across the country. And within a few years, the central commemorative element of two bugle sounds framing a period of silence, that is the last post, sometimes played alone but not too commonly, which is a call for lights out and a sleep to begin, which symbolises the sleep of death, and the reveille, a call to receive the dawn, symbolising the awakening from death in resurrection. Together, these two sounds conjoin mourning and hope with death and resurrection. Some do reference the last post as though it stands alone, but the addition of the reveille functioned as the soldiers' wakening call in the same way as trumpet fanfares and national anthems at funerals functioned as a reference to the resurrection. The emergence of the two bugle sounds in the form that we are familiar with today, in funereal and ceremonial contexts, had moved them beyond their military meaning, both theologically and commemoratively, to make a statement about the fallen. There was, in fact, a theme of certainty and immediacy in the dead soldier's destiny, an assurance for the living that they will be reunited with loved ones in heaven on the day of resurrection. And this was a bold and consistent statement of both Archbishop Wright and Dean Talbot and their evangelical theology, which underpinned their approach to Anzac Day. Talbot had, in fact, organised this public gathering in Sydney's domain. He was its service reader, and even though it had a necessary ecumenical flavour, it was an Anglican form of worship. The preacher, as I've mentioned, was Archbishop Wright, there on the left, who reiterated to the 60,000-strong crowd the sermon he'd given that morning in St Andrew's Cathedral, saying, referring to the sacrifices of Gallipoli, that many sons of Australia sleep till Resurrection Day. This indelible connection of sacrifice and resurrection is central to Sydney's Anzac Day in 1916. It provides a salient connection between the sacrifice of Australian men and women in the First World War and the sacrifice of Jesus. That year, in fact, Easter Sunday was the 23rd of April, 2 days before. Many would have heard in sermons that the sacrifice of death is given context and meaning by the resurrection from the dead, with the ultimate hope that suffering would end in the life to come. The sacrifice is therefore not the end, but in a collective sense, the symbol of the resurrection to come. The Anzac story does not end with sacrifice, but with a realisation that new life can emerge from suffering and death, and that those who have fallen on the battlefield are indeed the first fruits of this hope. For Talbot and for Wright, a point is being made about how to view Anzac Day. It affirms Talbot's confidence that after honouring the dead in the morning, we rejoice in the afternoon because we know that their death will not be in vain. The sacrifice of individuals, families, and indeed nations will ultimately be remembered as a trial of fire that will be transformed by the dawn of a certain hope on Resurrection Day. And from this early point, Anzac Day in Sydney conveys the full story of Easter. And in fact, by departing from a full solemn day, it rejects the idea promoted by Garland that it would be an All Souls Day. Because how would a focus on solemnity alone provide and sustain hope? How would Anzac Day best encompass the idea of a new dawn? And so, these first Anzac Day practices in 1916, both spoken and silent, connected both death and resurrection. They laid a foundation for the next decade of Anzac commemoration, which was to culminate in the advent in Sydney in 1928 of a service at dawn as Australia's unique expression of First World War memorialisation and which embedded resurrection once again at its core. The insistence on a solemn morning and a grateful afternoon and evening and the careful placement of silence leaves no doubt about the roots of that first Anzac Day in Sydney in theology consistent with an All Saints Day or an All People's Day rather than an All Souls Day. Archbishop Wright and Dean Talbot's theology which was dominant in its time, explains Anzac Day commemoration practice that remains recognisable and is observed by Australians to this day. The public expressions of Anzac remembrance that took shape in the hands of Wright and Talbot from that very first day in 1916 were moulded from evangelical Anglican liturgical forms. I'm just surprised that written out of the history on anything that you read about Anzac Day is the fact that Archbishop Wright is addressing 60,000 people in Sydney in 1916, when a lot of historians babble on about what was going on in Brisbane and nothing in Melbourne, as though nothing was happening. Here in Australia's largest city, its premier religious leader was in charge of Anzac Day and addressing a crowd of 60,000. And if you look closely, you can see women, you can see soldiers, you can see regular civilians in their hats. It was a large crowd representative of Sydney at that time. So I want to just turn to something that can always be a bit more visually interesting, and that is a memorial. As Jack mentioned, I worked at the Anzac Memorial as the director for a number of years before taking leave from the public service. That responsibility also included responsibility for memorials across the state, not in the sense of being the custodian of them, but ensuring that they were cared for by someone, an RSL or a local council or an institutional society of some sort, but also that funds were available to repair them if necessary. And this is what happened in Marrickville's case. And so I want to show how the theme of death and resurrection is present in the format of Anzac Day, the two halves and its ritual elements, but is also present in memorial designs. From the simplest obelisks, such as the first Sydney Memorial erected in 1917 that marks the beginning of the city's Anzac Parade, here on the right, that is a 1917 obelisk memorial at the top of Anzac Parade, just outside Sydney Cricket Ground. To the grand culminations of Australia's post-war memorial movement, notably Sydney's Anzac Memorial Building, where I worked, with its star-lined dome dedicated in 1934, the gaze of someone coming to those memorials is lifted into the heavenly realms. Sky-piercing obelisks, starry domes, and also goddess-angel sculptures all serve to focus aloft mourning and hope for a grieving and grateful nation. And one such example of a goddess is the Marrickville War Memorial, erected in 1919 to commemorate more than 450 men of the inner city Sydney suburb. It's a winged victory atop a pedestal some 4 metres tall, holding wreath and sword and evoking this skyward's hope. And its symbolism, the monument exemplified Anzac commemorative thought and practice of its time. Recently, the memorial has been brought down to earth, as I say, partially relocated to an indoor exhibition space in the Australian War Memorial, displayed as an example of the post-war memorial movement, interestingly, but without any ability to actually understand its symbolism, I might say. That's not in my notes, by the way. And a replica sculpture has now been installed in Marrickville in 2015, which has made some subtle changes, which is what we're going to focus on in a moment, to the figure's gestures. These interventions have compromised the symbolism of the original design, which communicated the particular idea of victory in the First World War that also could be aligned with Sydney's approach to Anzac commemoration. The meaning that this symbolism embodied for its original audiences, which aligned with the emerging motifs and rituals of Anzac Day itself, were represented in the Marrickville War Memorial design, built immediately in the post-war era, but they're now lost to us. The echo of marking victory in Sydney was still resounding, in fact, when the Marrickville Memorial was conceived. Some 250,000 people, once again, were in Sydney's domain. This is a photo that goes on to another page of the newspaper, which is an extension of this crowd. Is it 250,000 people? Who can count? It's huge. But they're reported to have gathered in Sydney's domain 2 days after the First World War armistice, in November 1918. The ceremony had been organised to celebrate the ending of the conflict. The crowd was reported at the time as larger than any that had previously gathered in Sydney. City dignitaries mingled with a dense mass of other Sydneysiders, returned soldiers and nurses, long-suffering families, all welcoming the prospect of loved ones returning home, the certainty that no more volunteers would be needed to venture across seas to almost certain ordeal. The ceremony of thanksgiving for the end of the war was organised at the request of the New South Wales Government by Dean Talbot, who in his own address to this gathering enjoined his hearers that we must not fail to remember the immortal ones who gave their lives that this great victory should be consummated. He painted a picture of the immortal Gallipoli dead rising from their graves, echoing the theme of death and resurrection that had been central to Sydney's Anzac Day commemorations since they were instituted by Talbot himself just 3 years before. The November 1918 edition of the official news organ of Australia's veterans movement, the Returned Sailors and Soldiers Imperial League, now the RSL today, declared, I quote, that nothing like it had been heard before, noting that, as the Dean concluded, a roar of applause rolled from the great sea of upturned faces, and that it was a speech that will live long in the memory of those who heard him. Once again giving attribution to Talbot's standing in the community. Having focused in their November edition on marking the end of the war, the editors of The Soldier, the news magazine, turned their attention to remembrance. And so the December issue, the following month, devoted its cover to an image of a design for a new war memorial in Marrickville. Fashioned by Gilbert Doble, a local sculptor, who also did the Piermont Memorial, if you're from around this area, the design featured a female heavenly figure heralding an approach to memorial symbolism that gave expression to the Anzac and the Judeo-Christian theme of death and resurrection. Just as Jesus' sacrificial death on the cross was followed by his bodily resurrection, these local citizens, to be honoured by the memorial, were not only to be remembered for their sacrificial death on the battlefield, but would participate in the future resurrection of the dead, made possible by the eternal nature of his overcoming of death, providing comfort to the bereaved and the hope of reunion on the day of resurrection. Jesus' final victory over death was the touchstone for understanding victory in war, for both involved suffering, but the achievement of peace, far from being triumphalist, was to be received by a grateful nation with humble thanksgiving. This central Christian belief about the nature of victory was what Talbot instilled in Anzac Day commemorations in Sydney, and he was to evoke in that Armistice Thanksgiving in November 1918. And again, the design of the Marrickville War Memorial aligned with these beliefs and practices. So this was the cultural repository that was understood by those drawing on its symbolism. The bugle sounds that we've already referenced and the gesture of wreath laying, which we'll come to in this memorial symbolism, which to modern eyes can seem secular, also bear significant religious meaning. For a wreath was a part of the Christian repertory of the early decades of the 20th century, containing death and new life, a decayed object that undergoes transcendence each spring. A floral wreath is a potent reliquary for the public commemoration of those who died in war. With its nestling of fresh flowers in a circle of evergreens, the ability to address the profound and at times overwhelming grief experienced by those who lost loved ones, and the hope that they are in a better place, as well as the national pride in their sacrifice and the hope for a better world today, are all uniquely contained in the wreath. In fact, the use of a wreath to symbolise the hope for this new life among the living was an example of the appropriation of long folklore into Christian practice and interpretation. And at a time when the community was in deep mourning for personal losses of family and friends, and for the cumulative impact of these losses on national mood, the comforting symbolism of a wreath marked victory over battlefield death and pointed to the eternal nature of the peace for the believer in heaven. The one who had fallen in war will be raised to heavenly glory. In fact, the roots of wreaths were solidly planted in Christian thought and practice. Jesus' victory over death through his sacrifice on the cross and his rising to new life was visible and tangibly represented in a perfect and circular, unbroken wreath decorated with everlasting flora. The appropriation of classical symbolism framed wreaths within this Christian symbolism, life after death and the resurrection. It spoke to both fragility of life and the everlasting perfection. Winged Victory was unveiled in May 1919 by the Governor of New South Wales. It's located in the Civic Square in front of the Town Hall, visible from shops, roads and homes, and directly opposite the Anglican Church with its towering steeple in congenial alignment. I'll show you back earlier in this image, so you can see from behind that's now looking from the Town Hall across through the memorial to the Anglican Church across the road. So that's the Civic Square of its day. So as I say, Winged Victory was unveiled in May 1919 by the Governor. Its inscriptions at its base, you can see the names there, pay lasting honour to more than 450 men of Marrickville. Those who are enlisted are also a list. They're alphabetical, three sides. The magnificent bronze sculpture, though, atop the memorial resembles a female angel or Athena Nike, the Greek goddess of victory. And she's supported by a 4-metre pedestal rising above the platform of names. Marrickville's angel, with mournful gaze, as you can see there a bit more clearly, holds her sword aloft, symbolising victory with honour, and a wreath is proffered in tribute to the individual and collective sacrifices of the community. The image of Nike, or Winged Victory, was familiar in art and design of the pre-war period. The famous Winged Victory of Samothrace had been found in the 1860s and exhibited in the Louvre Museum in Paris from the 1880s. You can still see it when you go in. Believed to have sat forward of the bow of a victorious seagoing vessel, the Samothrace figure's robe clings to the body as if pushing into the wind. Doble borrowed this motif, sculpting the gown across the body to communicate a similar windswept bearing as though she had descended from the heavens. Nike's representation of ancient Greek notions of victory had led to her depiction on modern Olympics medals from their reinception in Athens in 1896. So just note the timing just before the war, where she's seated with a palm frond in the left hand, a symbol of peace, and a wreath ready to be bestowed in her right hand, establishing another instance in the pre-war period of the symbolic connection of a wreath, not only with victory, but also with honour. Doble was emphasising the downward gestures of a mourner and the skyward hopes of a grieving and grateful nation. In his interpretation of the classical model, the heavenly figure came down to this world to offer tribute. The design for the memorial in Marrickville held together this double meaning of commemoration, that of grief at loss, and the tribute that it brings forth, and the sense of completion that the war was finished. There's no triumphalism in the figure's demeanour. The cast of her face was one of resignation rather than triumph. In looking down, she's acknowledging the sacrificial loss involved in gaining peace. It was a design for peacetime that captured the post-war spirit. The figure held a wreath in her right hand, offered in tribute, and the sword is held aloft in the left hand. Having done its job, victory has been achieved. There's no further need to have the weapon ready. In fact, the sword is vertical, pointing into the sky, drawing eyes heavenwards and acknowledging the genuine peace. True victory is in fact in the hands of God. It's unsheathed, but it is in the left hand, the inactive hand. It was not held with further fighting in prospect. The wreath is the object that is in the active hand, the right hand, bestowing a floral tribute in the classical symbol of victory accomplished. So Marrickville's Winged Victory held the promise of finality, a sacrifice that spoke of both death and resurrection. Death in the listing of names of those who did not return and in the pattern of the floral tribute established by her active gesture, but also resurrection in the symbolic visitation from the heavens and in the completed work of the now inactive weapon of war. But since its unveiling many decades ago, Marrickville Council has had to contend with repairs for the bronze figure, weathered by atmospheric exposure high above the ground, and on two occasions it's had to leave the column bare while repairs were undertaken. And in fact, finally, in 2013, whilst considering options to restore the sculpture once again, the council settled on the transfer of ownership to the Australian War Memorial, as I've mentioned there on the right hand of the screen, for its First World War galleries, and for a design competition to replace sympathetically the landmark figure. It is the second decision by the Council that I will focus upon today, and that is to replace the Winged Victory with a replica, selected through a design competition, but in which the idea of victory has been confused. The new winged female figure on the right has been placed on the pedestal and stands high above street level, above the plinth names, along with her sword and her wreath, and remains in direct lineage with both Nike and with Doble's angel. At a quick glance, the new sculpture might appear to be faithful in detail, but there are crucial differences that lead to this confusion about how to portray victory. Unlike the original figure, who held the sword in her left hand and the wreath in her right, the new design transposes the hands so that the sword is in the right hand and the wreath in the left, changing the interpretation of the memorial. Throughout art history, some of you will perhaps know better than I, that the work of hands is a potent element in understanding the world that is revealed. Handedness is critical to interpretation in both classical mythology and in the Christian scriptures. But this has not been appreciated by the designers of this reincarnated figure. The symbolism of the sword and the wreath is now muddled. The wreath has been moved to the inactive left hand, and as well as now being in the right active hand, the sword has been lowered, both changes in gesture conveying the meaning that further fighting may be in prospect, that the sacrifice may not yet be over. When held aloft in the left hand, the weaker hand, the sword symbolised that it had done its job and victory had been achieved. Now, the designer of the new memorial said, my aim was to design and make a 1920s sculpture, a little bit out, while reinventing particular elements of it. And so what I did was to bring the sword down at rest because it's more appropriate to have an image of peace and sacrifice rather than heroism. Now, this explanation is repeated in a plaque affixed to the podium of the memorial, which marked its renewed unveiling in 2015. Perhaps inadvertently, the attempt to present an image of peace achieves the opposite, because in the reimagined conception, the angel of victory still has work to do. The soldiers named on the plinth cannot be at rest, whether in this world, having returned from fighting, or in the next. Because originally the wreath was in the active hand, the right hand, bestowing a floral tribute, denoting that victory had now been accomplished. But the perfect wreath of victory no longer conveys this message of completion. The new active stance of the figure's body is consistent with this interpretation. Her face appears to be turned towards the names below her, but only in passing, as her body is in fact angled away in an active stance, as though having more to do. She pauses to give tribute before sword at the ready, winging her way to further battles. So the reinvention generates a fresh interpretation. The new form is cognizant of the experience that peace is only ever temporary. With hindsight, perhaps we might agree that this reality has triumphed over the hope that the First World War was the war to end all wars. But nevertheless, the altered configuration has resulted in a confusing ensemble of elements that no longer is consistent with the purity of left-right symbolism, and nor is it consistent with the original sculpture's assemblage that in its display of completion speaks of Christ's final victory and the eternal peace that it delivers. Just as a quick aside, the idea that swords as a memorial symbol or a commemorative presence somehow compromise peace is not evident, in fact, in Doble's design for Winged Victory. Some writers argue that a sword's appearance, such as those you might be familiar with in Commonwealth war grave cemeteries and in Imperial war grave cemeteries across the world, and its use, in fact, in the 1920 Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, where you have a soldier in recline with a sword across the body, that somehow these are martial in character. But in fact, what Doble shows is that the gesture involved in the presentation of the sword is also of importance. So you can have the sword ceremonial in its placement. In fact, the sword at the war grave cemeteries is displayed as though in cross formation, indicating, as with this original figure at Marrickville, and also with the Anzac Memorial in Hyde Park, where the centrepiece sculpture Sacrifice presents a dead soldier laying cross-like, supine across a sword, that peace can be wrought by God, even if won at a great price, the death of his son Jesus. So while the reinterpretation might reflect more contemporary understandings of war commemoration, sentiments born of hindsight, perhaps enveloped in anachronism, cloud the meaning of the memorial that was once held by the first generation that built it. The attempt to present an image of peace is classically understood achieving the opposite. The twin elements of mourning and hope were powerfully symbolised in Doble's Winged Victory, victory over death encountered sacrificially on the battlefield, and the assurance of an afterlife evoked through this victory, not only of the individual at rest, but for the nation now at peace. The Marrickville Memorial has been unshackled from these moorings and is no longer consistent with the Anzac liturgical forms steeped in Christian thinking and practice that actually occur before it each year. So Doble's design for the memorial held together this double meaning of commemoration, that of grief at lost and the tribute that it brings forth, but also the sense of completion that the war is finished. In other words, it was a design for peacetime. It demonstrated in design and practice that victory over an enemy was also victory over death through the sacrifice on the battlefield and the assurance of an afterlife that was evoked through this victory. In gathering publicly before such a memorial and others like it, there is recognition not only of the individual at rest, but of a nation now at peace. The First World War generation found meaning in looking skywards as well as down. And in this Marrickville War Memorial symbolism and in the community's practices that occurred before it, there was both ministration and assurance. The typical response of this generation was to place their experience in a wider, familiar context of Christian solace and hope. Judeo-Christian beliefs paired the death of an individual for a nation with an afterlife for both the individual and the nation, a resurrection confidence. So let me just say a few words in conclusion. Anzac Day's public demonstration of commemorative meaning based in the death and resurrection motif of Easter resonated simply and obviously with an Australian population that in the 1910s and 1920s was deeply Christian in its beliefs. At a time when almost every Australian believed in God and nearly 50% of the adherents were Church of England, its particular liturgical patterns were embraced by Australians in the midst of grief. In the early decades of the 20th century, Christian beliefs and forms knitted together both grief and hope. These beliefs and the forms generated respect for heart-rending loss, along with the tribute rightly deserved in its selflessness. They were also an expression of confidence in the future for a nation in mourning and in the prospect of reunion upon Jesus' return when the faithful would be raised to renewed life. The insistence by Talbot and by Wright that Anzac Day in 1916 be marked by both solemnity and joy anchored Anzac liturgy in Sydney's distinctive evangelical Anglican theology and a practice founded in a belief in the physical resurrection of the body. In Talbot's view, particularly, Anzac Day was like Easter Sunday, not only Good Friday. The sacrifices of a fledgling nation had meaning only if they are grounded in both death and resurrection. To benefit from the fruits of victory, the considerable loss of life required an equal sacrificial resolve by the living, and so Australia's post-war rebuilding was therefore given symbolic underpinning on Anzac Day through a full Easter theology.
Well, thank you very much, Darren. That was inspiring, I think.
Thank you for such an interesting address. And I congratulate you on the attainment of your doctorate during very difficult times for data gathering and analysis and examining process.
And others have experienced that this year.
Absolutely,
too.
I'm sure. So I wanted to ask you, because it was great to see documents that had the particular service being at noon. When did we move to things that acknowledge the dawn service? Can you say a little bit about that?
So the dawn service emerges in Sydney in 1928 and in fact is completely infused with an understanding of death and resurrection. The mythological story that has been handed down over the years is that a number of veterans who were partying on Anzac Eve 1927 before their day of commemoration stumbled along Martin Place, where the cenotaph was being built. And at that time, some of the stones had been laid, but not yet completed. It was to be unveiled in August 1927. But in April 1927, in the early hours of the morning, they witnessed a woman trying to place a floral tribute on that yet-to-be-completed cenotaph. They helped her do that, get through the construction work, stood with her in a moment of silent prayer, and then, having experienced this, resolved that they would return the following year with a formal occasion. And thus begins Australia's Anzac Day tradition on Anzac Day 1928, when 150 people then gather at the now completed cenotaph and in a sense baptise it for its first Anzac Day in that year. Subsequently, the dawn service takes off around the country. 1929 in Perth, 1930 in Albany, despite what you might read elsewhere, not till 1930 in Albany, down the southern end of Western Australia, right through to about Melbourne's one of the last. Melbourne's always behind with Anzac Day stuff. We'll perhaps not talk about that today. But I think there was some difficulty for Melbourne in situating itself separately as a state vis-a-vis the presence of the Commonwealth government in its city. Sydney had a lot more freedom to make decisions. Anyway, the dawn service emerges from that sort of story. And as you hear that story, or in fact when I heard it, I'm thinking immediately of the women who come to see Jesus' empty tomb, because that's what a cenotaph is. In fact, it is an empty vehicle for remembering the dead. And so I'm quite confident that whoever thought up that story, whoever thought up the dawn service, collectively they probably did it, had in mind that it somehow represented this fresh hope that was available on resurrection morning.
Darren, that prompts a question from me about the liturgical form of the first Anzac Day. Are there any documents that tell us what liturgical or quasi-liturgical form it had, whether prayers were read, scripture, whether it was just speeches?
Yes, so the services in 1916, both obviously in various denominational buildings throughout the morning, but then later at 12 noon in 1916, at varying hours over the years that follow, but ultimately settling on that sort of lunchtime approach to enable workers to attend, were all basically church services that you would find familiar. Clearly, you know, the Catholics weren't involved until much, much later, for obvious reasons. At times, there was some hope that by having a public gathering outside of a church building in a civic place, which was in fact the very decision taken in the first year, would somehow attract a wider audience, perhaps of Catholics, and in fact I think they did in 1917 certainly attend in some number, but there was no official ability to participate. So in fact in 1916, on that first Anzac Day, the Catholic St Mary's Cathedral held its service at the same time as the domain service. So it was at 12:15, a little bit later, but in that lunchtime period, which again was not uncommon, but they were marking St Mark's Day, the 25th of April. But in terms of liturgical form, it was very much a collection of hymns, and so Abide With Me is taken up very strongly in the domain in 1916 and has stuck ever since. There were a series of five prayers that focused on thanksgiving, you know, prayers in remembrance of those who had passed, prayers for those who were still suffering at home, and then prayers for those particularly in grief. And so, in fact, in liturgical form, and I haven't gone into this detail today, but the final prayer that would sort of lead to a silence was, in fact, the prayer about those suffering in grief, which would enable them in that silent prayer to remember their loved ones. So there was an intentionality about how silent prayer was being used in the liturgical forms. And so there's a whole interesting area, again, around what liturgy was being produced for wartime. So even before Anzac Day, you had in January, the first Sunday of January each year, beginning in 1915, there was a national day of prayer and commemoration, and Archbishop Wright wrote the liturgy for those. And so they were distributed widely around the country. So the Anglican form of worship, which the Protestants didn't have a lot of trouble just adapting and adopting, was in fact the frame that was given to those early services. So there was singing, there was prayer, as well as speeches.
Thank you, Darren. I was just flabbergasted with your talk. First of all, because I've just stood down from the Committee of Marrickville Heritage Society.
Oh, okay. So, yes.
And I know there's been a long, long, very heated...
Mm. Yes, I've brushed over about, some legal issues and
people did not want... Mm. You know, they blamed the council for not looking after the statue to begin with. And I actually saw it when it was virtually in two parts anyway and at the council storage area before it went off to Canberra. So, but there's it's still divided, the opinions about the new and the old. But thank
I'm not
you.
I'm helping
just,
that divide.
I just love that. But and I wanted to say a couple of things, but one is the mayor who organised the statue, I can't remember his name right at this moment, but he was a leader of a very strident Protestant organisation, and Marrickville was the centre of incredible sectarianism and anti-Catholic feeling. So that's kind of part of that background.
Sounds odd.
Because we had the Jurga, Father Jurga from Marrickville Church, also, you know, as part of that background just two years before the statue. But the mayor was a leading light in all that.
Okay.
So you've kind of answered my main question, which was what was the part of the Catholic Church in all this? In my research, doing work on the Brigidine Sisters down at Cowra, I was really astounded to learn that the Catholics were forbidden to take part in the Anzac Day celebrations. And that really, I had not realised that, and I'm not sure at what stage that was relaxed. What we do need to keep in mind, in 1916 you've got the referendums, the constriction referendums,
one
about
one, year,
yes, so you've got that sectarian feeling already, and so I'm assuming the Catholics would have been forbidden to be in the domain for that ceremony?
Yes, technically, yes.
Technically, but... Who knows? It would be very interesting to know that.
Yes, I think in 1916, because of the freshness of it, I think the Catholics probably decided their best option was to hold a ceremony at the same time, not only as a negative sense, but as a positive. You know, if you felt that you were not able to go because of Catholic dictate, then here was an offering that you could participate in at the same time. So I think there was some level of respect and acknowledgement that here was a momentous day and we had to do something together. There was an attempt by moving out into the public space to not just confine it to St Andrew's Cathedral, for example, which they could have done. And then, in fact, what they did in Brisbane. So in Brisbane, they just stayed within each of their denominational settings. They only came out into the public space to mark the parade of veterans, the march, and then they went back to sort of local town meetings. So there was never any really... This is the other big thing that Sydney did, was create this public gathering sense that we could do on Anzac Day itself. The Catholics officially are not able to join until, you'll have to help me, Jack, it's the late 50s or early 60s, when an accommodation is sort of reached around what is actually happening in that public gathering. So although it still looks like, to all intents and purposes, an Anglican church service, I think there was some recognition that by involving various parties, including Jewish clergy, that it was less of a religious service and could be considered just a public gathering. And so I think, is it Gilroy who comes to that decision, I think, and frees it up? And another thing that had already occurred in Sydney was in the late 50s, there'd been a dispute between the RSL, of course, and some other leading lights in the retired services, usually the officer class, who wanted certain things to still happen on Anzac Day, and the RSL was getting jack of it. So there was a bit of a parting of the ways in the late 50s, and what you get is that the lunchtime type service is taken over by the RSL in that era. And so I think once it's under the leadership of the RSL, again, the Catholic Church felt, oh, there's a possible accommodation available to us here.
Mm. Thank you. It was a fabulous talk.
Thank you, Janice. We'll talk about Cowra afterwards for a reason. Yes.
Thank you very much for a fascinating talk. And when Jack told me you were speaking today, I searched for your name online and was very happy to find your PhD online.
Oh, yeah, good.
Which yes. helps, though. And I actually gave a talk here last year on... I'm researching 500 Sydney Medical School doctors of... and I gave a talk here on last year on the those a selection of those of Irish Catholic descent. But and you said that you know, the most people of that era believed in God, but on the other hand, you know, Darwin's theory of evolution, it was 50 years before, and I doubt that most of the doctors, well, many of them would have, and some became missionaries, but I doubt that most of them, well, many of them would have believed in God. But and maybe there's, when I look at the religion of all those 500 doctors, you know, there's a spread, as you'd expect, reflecting the population of the day. Our daughter happens to be in Avignon in the south of France in the last couple of days, and she said she was going for lunch at a place called Gord, little village called Gord, G-O-R-D-E-S. So I did a Wikipedia of that, and lo and behold, there was a nice war memorial there.
Indeed,
there would so be. I just wonder to what extent the French... started commemorating the war in the way we did with Anzac Day.
Yes, I'm not entirely sure, but what I can point to is that France is largely a Catholic nation, and Australia and the United Kingdom is largely Protestant nations at the time. There was something distinctive about how commemoration was occurring. And so, as far as I can tell, in France it would have still happened in the local Catholic church, and there may have then been a parade afterwards of some sort. And certainly their memorials are not too different from ours. A lot is made sometimes of how on our memorials we list both those who didn't return as well as those who did. So all who went away are commemorated, whether they've returned or not. That also happens in France. You know, it's not necessarily unique to Australia in the way we commemorate this, but sometimes something made of that, which I don't think is quite as true as we might think. On the question of religion at the time, yeah, I mean... one's beliefs are one's private beliefs, and so you can tick anything in a census box, as you can read over this weekend, even as people analyse what's come out of our most recent census. But the 1911 census says basically between 98 and 99% of people tick, yes, I believe in God, and I associate with a particular denomination. And as the Anglicans would claim, it was nearly 50% of them would claim adherence to Anglicanism. So in meetings with the government leadership of the day, it would tend to still be at that time the Anglicans who held sway as to what might occur in public spaces. And that's why you see, or I see as I read the newspaper records, that the government in New South Wales is constantly turning to Wright and Talbot to organise things, because they've got the liturgical capacity, they've got the sort of authority of leadership across many people, and without the partisanship that might emanate from government itself and indeed from the RSL at the time. So, yeah, I think although we can't be certain in making grand statements about what people believed at the time, we can only go on what they might share with us. In an aggregate sense, what they shared with us is the census data of 1911. I'm actually involved in a memorial to a doctor from World War II at St John's College, so we might talk afterwards over coffee as well. Thank you.
In that 1911 census, there was a total of about 1,000 people out of a population of 5 million, less than 1%, who put themselves down as not believing in God at all. So the difference, even anecdotally, whether one believes the precise details of the numbers, the difference anecdotally is immense. And so that's
and that's a helpful point, Jack, as well, because no funeral could be conducted legally other than by the clergy. So for the government to turn to the clergy for help in devising something that was marking death just makes complete sense. And I just wonder why historians have not actually realised that as they look back at the past and think the veterans were doing everything, they weren't. They weren't really involved in Anzac Day other than they made a parade happen. Over time, that changed.
I was going to ask you when the march became the most dominant thing. It seemed ever since my childhood, the Anzac Day march has been the thing that you think of. The dawn service and then followed by the Anzac Day march. When did that become such a big issue?
Yes, it's a very good question, and I think it's really World War II that does that, because in World War II, a population at the end of 7 million Australians, more than 1 million of them had served in uniform. And so the critical mass of people who would like to mark that day by marching with those with whom they'd served, whether on the home front or overseas, was phenomenally large. And so I think that's where these marches, they're called marches in Sydney, they're called parades in other places. I get confused sometimes, but it's definitely a march here. So a parade is often focused on existing military, not veterans. A march is about the veterans. Can be others as well, yeah. But what was happening after World War II was that, in fact, and that's when the RSL becomes sort of super, you know, present in Anzac Day and begins to take it over. And that's where they had the confidence to take over the lunchtime ceremony in Sydney, at least in the late 1950s. And even today, you know, the last 10 or 20 years, people have been bemoaning the gradual decline of that Second World War generation and its availability to look after Anzac Day. It's really it's a civic responsibility. It's not a veteran's responsibility to look after Anzac Day. We've all got to remember what happened and what went on. But I think in answer to your question, it's not an interwar thing. It's a post-World War II thing.
I can remember during the Second World War going to watch marches,
I'm sure.
Being involved.
Oh, they were definitely happening.
Wearing a big white handkerchief with a red cross on the top.
Oh, yeah.
Dressed up as a red cross. Going with a group of school people.
Yes. No, definitely in 1916 and from then on, it had that form. That's right. The march would occur in the morning.
Once again, thank you for your address. I've had a very interesting.
Thank you.
Could I ask, could you tell us about the evolution of Anzac Day as a public holiday? And I don't mean that in a crass way. It just gives people the ability to participate in the services, et cetera, and even as spectators.
Yes. That's a very good question. And I think actually there's a book to be written still on this very question, because there's not a lot of evidence available. Other than just doing the hard research and looking at every state almost, looking at New Zealand as well and what happened. But what I can share with you is this, that in Sydney, they held the line on the two halves model, even though some states, particularly after the war, were keen for the whole day to be devoted to activities that were of a solemn nature. And that, in fact, meant for many proponents of the full day of solemnity that somehow you would need the public holiday to get attendance, because otherwise people would have to go to work. And so the compromise that was possible from a civic point of view and a business point of view aligned with what was actually already going on in Sydney. So in 1924, the New South Wales government was approached by a delegation of some 50 leaders, including Talbot, to sort of try and sort this out, you know, and define what it would mean for the state of New South Wales. And it led to the two halves model being embedded in legislation in late 1924, so that from Anzac Day 1925, you had this half day where no work was to be performed, but in the afternoon you could go back to work. And that's what we experience today and what is in fact experienced around the whole country. So even though then some states, like Queensland in particular, almost right up to World War II, New Zealand, who had reversed its position during the war, had been following the two halves model after the war, panicked and went back to took up the full day option. Again, I think Garland went over to New Zealand for a while and might have had some influence on that. So there's a mixture going on all over the place. But ultimately, what was embedded in legislation in 1924 in New South Wales Parliament became what then cascaded across the country in the 20s. So by the end of the decade, everybody had worked out their public holiday arrangements. Some of them were full days at that time still, like Queensland, as I say, but many of them weren't.
Would you say that things changed when CEW Bean got in charge of the War Memorial and Anzac commemoration? I mean, as I understand it, he was vaguely religious but not really Christian. I can't see him believing in resurrection. Would you say his attitude sort of hijacked Anzac Day from the Christians or something like that?
Oh, that's an interesting thought. What I do know about... Bean's brother, who served at Gallipoli, was well known to Talbot, was in fact in the St Andrew's Cathedral Choir, and he and Talbot obviously connected again, not only in Sydney at the cathedral, but at Gallipoli. So there was already a connection to Bean and the family more broadly. In fact, I've just got a vague recollection that Talbot might have even presided at Bean's marriage, his wedding, after the war. But coming to the nub of your question, the Australian War Memorial is not, in fact, unveiled until 1941. So it's a long time after the states have built their own, what they called national memorials, like our Anzac Memorial, like the Shrine of Remembrance, etc. And so the Australian War Memorial was already then facing a World War II collection problem. But two things to say. One is that the design of the Australian War Memorial is a cross. So without a doubt, it was infused by a Christian thinking about what death and perhaps resurrection meant. And the reason I can have some confidence about then how it was understood at the time, including Napier Waller's, you know, stained glasses and even some of the ways, in fact, things are done within the site itself in those early years, is because Treloar, who was actually in charge of the memorial, Bean was, in a sense, the historian and the one who had imagined that we might have a memorial in our capital city eventually that was a museum, an art gallery, to a degree an education centre, but also a commemorative space. What was built was the commemorative space and exhibition space, not the art gallery, in a sense. But Treloar was very much a Protestant, very, very a man of great conviction, and so I'm not persuaded that Bean had that much influence in the end over what went on there and perhaps the interpretation in its early days after World War II. Of course, this is a story for another day, but by the time you get to the 1960s, you've got this sort of shift back to trying to interpret Anzac Day as a classical model, you know, even sort of thinking about what this goddess might mean. The focus will be on what is Nike. The focus in interpretation of the shrine is mistakenly often about Pericles or, you know, Greek tradition, when in fact it's infused completely by Christian thinking and scripture. So, yes, there are some challenges about trying to work out what this influence meant, because in a sense it was just the culture, you know, as we're saying about the 1911 census and even the ones that followed in the interwar period, a lot of people would have turned to this on a day marking death, without a doubt.
I followed the theme of the observance of the wars in the two churches just out of personal interest over the years. And, for example, I saw the Poziers crosses that are in Sydney, one at St. Anne's, one at St. John's in Gordon. Yep. There's the one at St. Columba's. So they're all in Protestant churches, and whenever I went looking for there's one at North Sydney as well, St. Thomas's, where they've got the battalion flags. So never, ever found a trace of any mention of the war in any Catholic church until maybe I got to France or somewhere, like up in Fromelles somewhere. So the... an old priest told me exactly what has been said today, that Catholics were barred from the Anglican stylings of the Anzac Memorial.
Yes.
But to me, I wonder whether it's there is the sectarian differences that keeps them out of each other's jurisdiction.
but also a whole different outlook to the war, during the war, after the war, in connection with perhaps the Irish Catholics. My great-great-grandfather wouldn't let his sons join the British Army until he died in 1915. There was still a lot of feeling, well, we're not backing the British in this one, and that's a great, a big swathe of Irish Catholics. So the war, you know, and people like Mannix, the opposition to the concept, there was maybe an ambiguity or a wish to distance themselves from sort of the judgment, whether this was a just war or not. So I wonder if you might say something about that, that it's not just the difference of each other's turf, but a whole different attitude to the conduct of the war, to the fact of having the war.
No, thank you. That's a very helpful comment. And I've got a couple of reflections, but if I just pick up on the issue of whether there's representation within Catholic churches, interestingly, in my work, I've landed at St John's College to help them with a memorial, as I mentioned just briefly. They're the only college, I think, on University of Sydney campus, Jack, that doesn't have a war memorial. And so they're seeking to correct that in a way and doing it in their particular style, which I'm quite supportive of. But there are other places, like St Mary's Cathedral has got the George Lambert sculpture in the crypt. Yeah, so it's got a representation of what the unknown soldier looks like in Westminster Abbey. So there is a sort of joining of the ways there, perhaps. But just two reflections on what you were saying. It's in the 1930s, isn't it? It was made for there, yeah, designed for there, yeah. So one of the interesting things, I just vaguely referenced McAuliffe and Talbot working together at Lone Pine, for example. So a Catholic chaplain and the principal Anglican chaplain being together and being pragmatic, because urgency and scale meant that they had to sort of come up with solutions. The same was happening on the ships, or the hospital ships out in the Gallipoli harbour as well. And so that sort of ecumenism that was forced upon people did actually influence clergy on return. And although there were still theological differences, Talbot and McAuliffe shared some political stages at times. Talbot is quite a figure in Sydney's history. He's involved in the 8-hour day movement as well. He's very close to the workers, which might surprise people when he's an Anglican leader. In fact, it surprised the RSL that he was on the side of the workers. Who would have thought? So he was often with McAuliffe, and Wright was with Kelly, Archbishop Kelly, on those sorts of questions. So there was an attempt, whenever possible, to come together and represent the interests of the community at large, perhaps not only informed by the ecumenical imperatives of the front line in a war, but also by, I think, perhaps the conscription debates. And so that's my second point, that we've got a casual historical reflection on those conscription debates, which I think has been undermined by an historian who's looked quite closely at the data, which is that it's not as easily, whenever you look closely at data, you get complexity. I give that, but what he has shown is that the alignment between Catholics and rejection, Anglicans and Protestants and affirmation of the conscription questions, is not as easily portrayed once you start looking at the data. So there's movement around the edges and everywhere. And so I think it's more likely the Irish question than it is an actual conscription question that might continue to divide people in terms of empire. There's so much to be explored. I congratulate John Moses, who I mentioned a couple of times, in exploring in deep detail what was going on in Brisbane, because what it enabled him to do and for us to benefit from is a realisation of how involved religious leadership was in helping a community deal with the tragedy and catastrophe of war, and to do it sensibly. So you might read Michael McKernan, or you might read Ken Inglis, or you might read Bill Gammage. They're all a bit negative about religion in the end. But when you actually look at what's going on, I think there's much more profound expectation at which the clergy deliver you know, and I think here the Sydney story about how Anzac Day emerges and survives more or less in that form is testimony to their influence at that time. So congratulations to John Moses, but he overstates the Brisbane situation, and I hope that I might have brought the Sydney situation to light.
Professor Kilday has something to say on the Catholic aspect.
Yeah, just going back to that question of Catholic participation in Anzac Day, it was because it was a religious service that conducted along Anglican lines that was the problem for Catholics participating. Yes. And if you want to read about this, John Luttrell wrote an article for the Journal back in 1999. It seems from John's research that how the problem was ultimately resolved in Sydney was that members of the RSL and the armed forces would say the prayers and a religious person would give the civic address. Mm. And that then in Sydney was able to resolve the problem from 1962 onwards. Mm. That solution was tried in Melbourne in the 1930s. The problem was that there was to be no religious service but a civic address at the Shrine of Remembrance, which then caused the Anglicans to pull out because they didn't want there to be no religious service. So, yeah, but John Luttrell's article goes into it in quite some depth, and it's sort of an interesting explanation of some of the ridiculous things that were going on in those days, and the fact that that was the way they solved it. It's a bit like a lot of diplomacy, isn't it? You know, you've got to find the fudge to satisfy both sides.
No, that's very helpful. Thank you for that reminder at 62. And the sort of the fudging that goes on enables the Catholics to participate then in the sort of very public gatherings that are occurring here in Sydney. And what you've also reminded us of is how different each state was. And so, you know, again, historians have tended to be a bit lazy and focused on what goes on in Victoria. They talk a lot about the shrine. They talk a lot about how the veterans down there didn't want women attending Anzac Day ceremonies, which only happened in Melbourne, only briefly for a time, did not happen across Australia. And yet you'll read lots of casual references to how women were excluded in the 10s and 20s and 30s from Anzac Day itself. So just take note that back then there was not a lot of transport between capital cities. In fact, I think I read some data in Bob Birrell's book on Federation that was saying that even, you know, in that interwar period, it was some small percentage of people that had ever been to another state. So things have got their own culture in these, which we don't quite see the same way today. Although Jack, I thought, gave a good introduction to our life in Sydney at the beginning of our gathering.
Local Anzac commemorations are often hampered by inability to provide all the musical resources for the ceremonial music, and to address that problem, the Department of Veterans Affairs has provided some excellent recordings that can be played out. And the instruction that comes with the recordings says you use the reveille at a dawn service only, otherwise the rouse is coupled with the last post. Are you able to throw any light on the reasons for this distinction and when it came about and why?
That's too big a challenge, John. Is it John, is it?
John.
Yeah, thank you for the question. What I can say is that, yes, reveille is technically the awakening bugle call. And so when it was taken up into formal liturgy for Anzac Day and related events, it's notionally meant to only be used for the dawn service these days. But again, that's a later development. As I mentioned, dawn service is 1928, so we've already got 12 years of Anzac Day already. And so the coupling of the last post and reveille is intentionally about the second last bugle sound before you're meant to be asleep, and that's called the last post. There's another bugle call after that on barracks. So the last post is saying, you better watch it, because if somehow we catch you on the very last one, you're dead, you know, you'll be in jail. So it sort of ends with a rise in the music. But that rise is sort of almost saying, not quite yet, just not quite. And so you'll often see reflections in the newspapers of the time remarking on how the last post sort of leaves you expectant. You know, there's still something to come. And that something to come is the reveille, the bugle call that marks the reawakening of dawn. Now, the rouse, it's just become a defence, Department of Defence sort of solution, I think, because the reveille is quite lengthy. And so they prefer the rouse, a bit easier to play. I'm just giving you pragmatic answers, potentially, but there might be a point in history where some of this became more obvious, and it probably is after the dawn services emerged, and there's some sort of sense of, well, that really just relates to dawn, we should leave it there, and now we should use the rouse for the rest of the day. But they've got a similar meaning.
Thank you very much for the your talk. I was particularly interested in the Marrickville story, I suppose. I spent a lot of time in my life going back and forth through Marrickville, and I have to confess that I really didn't spend any time looking at the memorial. But now I'm wondering, especially when you put up those two pictures, it was, and from your explanation, I thought, my goodness, they've got it wrong. But in fact, was that intentional, or was that happen that way? And perhaps the lady from the Historical Society can tell us about the arguments about it, but was it intentional?
Well, I was able to quote what the designers, so Darrell Pullen and Peter Corbett, the two designers of the new version of Nike, took a view that somehow they were improving the symbolism, cognizant perhaps of we didn't end all wars, but also that somehow they were frightened of the way the sword was held aloft as though that was triumphalist. But that's actually a mistaken interpretation because it's in the wrong hand. If you see some old images in classical works and the sword is aloft in the right hand, it is triumphalist. It's sort of like saying, I'm the best, I was the most physically able to withstand our encounter, and so I raise my sword in victory, you know, I've won. But by doing in the left hand, what's being said is, actually, we've now removed the sword. Yes, it's a signal of the victory that's occurred, and we've removed it. So I think that discussion never really occurred. I tried to intervene, Janice, in 2013. I was still in government and aware of what was going on. I actually wrote a piece for the Sydney Morning Herald that didn't get published about this question, because Marrickville was already on a path that they felt was imperative. And there are some legal questions, which if Janice wants to talk about them, let her talk about them rather than me. Thank you.
Dr. Mitchell has been on his feet for over 90 minutes, so I think that we should adjourn from afternoon tea. I have to thank Darren on three grounds. First of all, his generosity in stepping in. Secondly, his willingness to share his thesis with us. And thirdly, for having held everyone's attention for so long and for such an engaged question time. So thank you very much indeed.
Could I just say thank you again to Jack, but also to all of you for such a welcome, but also thank you for your generosity in your questions, in asking and engaging with the material at hand. And just noting, we are about to mark on Tuesday, in fact at the Anzac Memorial where I'll be, the Battle of Fromelles, which is often cited as the first engagement of the Australian troops on the Western Front. And so in 1916, shortly after that first Anzac Day commemoration, the troops found themselves at Fromelles, and that's been marked on Tuesday.
We've been listening to Dr. Darren Mitchell, formerly Director of the New South Wales Anzac Memorial Sydney, speaking about Anzac Day Sydney 1916, an origin story, how the Anglican Church laid the foundations for Australia's National Day of Commemoration. The Q&A which followed was moderated by Dr. John Carmody, President of the Australian Catholic Historical Society. It all took place on Sunday, the 17th of July 2022, in the crypt of St. Patrick's, Churchill, Sydney, Australia. Dr. Mitchell's talk corresponds with the first of his planned trilogy of papers regarding Reverend Albert Edward Talbot, the Anglican Dean of Sydney. Under the title, What Dean Talbot Did Next, The Return of Chaplain Colonel Talbot to Sydney in 1916, that first paper was published in Lucas, an Evangelical History Review, Series 2, Number 12, December 2018. This ACHS podcast was made on the traditional lands of the Gadigal and Wattamedagal peoples of the Eora Nation. We acknowledge the prior custodianship by our First Nations people of all places in Australia where this podcast may be heard. There'll be another history talk on the afternoon of Sunday the 14th of August 2022 when Dr. Helen Belcher, co-chair of the Diocese of Maitland-Newcastle Diocesan Pastoral Council, will present a reflection entitled Walking the Synodal Path of the Fifth Plenary Council of Australia. We look forward to having you along for that talk. Until then, please stay well. This ACHS podcast was produced by me, John Kenny. Bye for now.